That's the first time I've sat next to Charles Altieri. I've been reading his work for decades and admiring it and using it and quoting it and thinking about it. So I'll just have to get over a bit of shock there to come down to earth. First of all, lovely to be here. And can I thank the organisers of this colloquium, this conference, this get-together? I know Kate and Annie and a number of others were very, very hardworking and very instrumental in getting this together. But really, it's the angel of transnational poetry and poetics, that is Lynn Hajinian, who's talking to us about pragmatic issues most of the time about the conference, but in fact, her spirit hovers over this at a much higher level. And it's one that also, for many decades, has been important to me. In Cordite, that magnificent journal where most of us get the good news about Australian poetry from, Lynn wrote that introduction in the Bay Area issue where she talked about our regions and the lack of connection between them in some ways and the importance or the timeliness of there being a conversation like this one. And that's something that we very much owe to. The fact that it's happening, we owe to Lynn's vision on this. I actually think we've needed each other for a long time, Lynn. I've got a... I think I'm the only person in Australia with a complete set of the Poetics Journal, which I've had since not long after it was published, and which over the years has been plundered by postgraduates and students and loaned out by me and photocopied and such that most of the issues are now falling apart. but for me also, it's been one of the really important series of documents that I've had in thinking about poetry over the years. And as you know, Lynn was a big part of that initiative and that little miracle of a book, writing in the aid of memory, comes out of that project at that time. So Lynn, salute.
He was the other half. Important person there. Yeah.
So, a first point about synchronicities. As I was starting to write this paper, a colleague in Boston introduced me to the poems of Kim Garcia. What caught my attention were some of her drone poems about this sci-fi dream of modern warfare from a book of poems due out later this year. In the drone poems I heard her read, she imagines the private or interior lives of drone pilots, even drone pilots' wives. She ponders the resonances of the proprietorial name Predator, that's the General Atomics name for its UAV, unmanned aerial vehicle. Drones undertake aerial reconnaissance and forward observation, and sometimes armed with Hellfire missiles are deployed in combat. Some weird ironies here, etymologically and entomologically, given that bee drones are stingless and are parasites rather than predators. They were quiet, precise, thoughtful poems. The same day, John Kinsella emailed from Tübingen, southern Germany, where he was living, attaching some new poems about observing birds. One was about watching European buzzards over the Österberg, which is a hill visible from his office at the university there. European buzzards are opportunistic raptors. They rarely flock. He imagines them as creatures of airborne surveillance. This is part of the poem. There is no science in observing a pair of buzzards high over the Österberg hill, and there is no separating there being an ancient eroded mountain in my head with a pair of wedge-tailed eagles gliding high over. Both high grounds are spiked with telecommunications. I've just been made aware that drones fly over here on their way from Stuttgart to Africa. They are to liberty as the buzzards and eagles are to rodents, rabbits and marsupials. All those design correlations, inspirations translated and rearranged as ordnance. The close equation in the poet's perception here, no separating, is between southwest West Australia's Mount Bakewell, or Wilwalinj, to give it its Aboriginal name, from Kinsella's wheat belt homeland, eroded over millennia, by contrast with the Oosterberg, engineered to smoothness by man, but both high ground suitable for telecommunications infrastructure. The buzzards circle on the thermals over the Oosterberg, above the hang gliders, likewise over Wilwalinj, another launch site for paragliding leisurists, wedge-tail eagle circle, also raptors, even more territorial than buzzards. The Oosterberg is on the flight path of US drones from secret bases in Ramstein and Stuttgart, heading for places like Somalia and the Middle East. In fact, the US Army's African Command is based in Stuttgart and conducts covert operations from there. The drones are also equipped with geolocating devices developed by the NSA on the bottom side of their wings that use mobile phone and SIM card signals to locate targets precisely. This geolocating system is called Gilgamesh. So, two unsought encounters of poetic language with the technologies of today's warfare. The poetics of remote platforms, if you like, which has at its core the contradictions and cross-species translations of nature, techne, and technology. Birds of prey, geolocation creatures, hang gliders, the internet, Sumerian epic narrative, and ordnance. This was also in the week of the release of Gavin Hood's film Eye in the Sky. A second point. As I was thinking about where this paper was beginning, went back to A.D. Hope and one of the loci classici of this topic in Australia, his essay, The Activists, which first appeared in Prospect, which is kind of Catholic New Left journal, in 1960. I was mishearing activist aesthetics here for activist aesthetics, but that's understandable, I think. Poetic innovation is linguistic activism, language art with a formal purpose. At least that's how it might appear. There was some crackle in the semantic signals of active and activist here that I could sense that needed more fine-tuning, more tuning into. Hope's essay was useful here. It reminded me that there is another referent to the word aesthetics here and a submerged problem, perhaps, with the idea of an active aesthetics. In that essay, Hope's argument was against any sense of primacy for social or political purpose in relation to artistic projects. This is even more true, he insists, of Aristotelian aesthetics, or mimesis, the theory that it is in the nature and function of art to tell us the truth about the world in which we live, to inform us, and by informing us, to instruct and delight. For Hope, the heresy or evil of activism, and his feelings are that strong, is also miscritiqued by the advocates at the other end of the historical scale, the art for art's sake crowd, the aesthetes, I guess, the ones in need of an anaesthetic. As he says, great art can have every possible kind of social, moral, or intellectual purpose. He has a particular brief for literary satire, or it can have none at all. It's not social or political purpose that's the problem. Rather, he has in his sights critical and philosophical positions, more than anything, as subsets of Aristotelian and modern aesthetics, of the idea of mimesis as the origin of art. That's what his target is. What he is most offended by is the idea that art is generated by anything other than the artistic poetic impulse. I guess that's the word. But Hope has no theory or vocabulary for this. Or any attempt to reduce poetic art, even the most wildly experimental expressions, to political tools or instruments, to the promotion of programs of social change or moral improvement, to the status of mere illustrations within the discourse of aesthetics. The predictably conservative and dismissive aspect of this essay, and it didn't necessarily need to go down this track, but it does, The predictably conservative and dismissive aspect of the essay is the corollary, the other he wants to imagine, that entrapped or deluded poets or artists produce works, mediocre or worse, according to a social or political program and then measure or judge their value against that program. The essay gets out of control at the end when Hope illustrates his liberal ahistorical aesthetics with the fable of Titian's painting Bacchus and Ariadne on Naxos, 1522. He has to do this because he doesn't trust poetics as a subset of aesthetic discourse. He can't deal with the implicated languages of critique and poetry. He seeks the Aufhebung, so he swerves away from his own topic of aesthetics and activism into a kind of banal dichotomy of genius and talent. Those of you who know Hope's work will recognise the gesture. It occurs over and over again in his work. He wants to allegorise experiment and ambition. He can recognise these in art. But contra the innovative, radical and processual traditions of his time. For Hope, content is never more than an extension of form. This produces mirror halls of ambivalence and hopelessness, often cast in mythical and biblical costumes. Titian's painting, for example, that he relies on for his fable, is already an ekphrasis of Catullus 64 and of Ovid. So one might feel like saying to Hope, look, if you're interested in this particular set of questions, then forget Ariadne on Naxos and have a look at the dossier on Anna Akhmatova, for example, as just one 20th century case study. It's full of much more relevant contradictions and complexities, not to say human tragedy. Her congenital allergy to the suffocating ideological strictures of socialist realism, the late poems, the late poems for Stalin, and her anxieties and guilt about the fate of her son, the history of Requiem, all that. Is that unfair? Well, there's also a footnote here. In 1971, a decade after the activist's essay, Hope's poem, Inscription for Any War, a kind of expanded imitation of Simonides' frequently translated epitaph of the 300 against the Persians at Thermopylae, was included in and provided the title for Shirley Cass, Roz Chaney, David Malouf and Michael Wilding's anti-war anthology, We Took Their Orders and Are Dead. It's published in 1971. This is Hope's poem, the whole lot. Linger not, stranger, shed no tear. Go back to those who sent us here. We are the young they drafted out, to wars their folly brought about. Go tell these old men safe in bed, we took their orders and are dead. It's one of the more powerful pieces in the anthology, and the inclusion of the word drafted perhaps the most political detail for any Australian reader. A third point led on from thinking about Hope's struggles to expound a conservative aesthetics. I was still trying to get started thinking about Hope's relegation of aesthetics, his barely articulate privileging of the autonomous, sovereign poetic imagination, whatever its focus or medium. There was a big gulf, but also a line of connection back to a critical article by Avital Ronell in Pierre Millet, no less, in 2005. She began that article by saying there were a couple of things that really burned her up. One was colleagues and students not saying hello to her in the street. The other, which she relates to other serious stuff that she's doing in that article, and the other was the repudiation or forgetting of poetry by young theory heads, that was her word, she either taught or encountered in seminars. So her essay is about the misery of theory without poetry, or the idea that aesthetics knows more than art, or that poetics knows more than poetry. In her rage at this unforeseen scenario, Ronell refuses the genealogical move of going back through the DNA helix of poetry and philosophy to explain how things have reached such a pass. She could do that, she doesn't. As well, she doesn't scold the young theory heads, although there are moments of apophasis, not saying something by not saying it, at work in the rhetoric of the argument. No, like a good teacher, rather, she confronts the divorce of poetry and theory she has discerned in intellectual life by staging an exemplary encounter between thinking and poeticising. The scene is Heidegger's reading of Hölderlin's Andenken, Remembrance, or sometimes Souvenir. One of his poems, or hymns they're usually called, about remembering his experiences in Bordeaux, and written in Tübingen, as it happens. Ronell's relentless tracking of Heidegger on Hölderlin, which collates different published and archival versions of the lectures and their complex political and institutional contexts, begins with Heidegger's appropriation or greeting of Hölderlin and goes into depth about the paradoxes and contradictions of mastery of a poem, the implications for its meanings and the reader's reception. What Ronell obsessively dramatises here are the tensions between a poem that ends with the famous line, "Was bleibet aber, stiften die Dichter," but poets establish what remains, and a discourse like Heidegger's that aims to master and dominate it, even while it is neurotically hyper-aware of Hölderlin's text's immunity to such attempts. There's a lot of other hermeneutics going on in Ronell's reading, but essentially the enactment is about the power and generativeness of the poetic word, in this instance, in the register of German Romanticism. It's all there in the word stiften, the infinitive form in German, but close also to the imperative, donating, establishing, founding, sanctuary, gifting, subjective and social, visionary and affective, but embodied in the quasar of a poetic linguistic entity. The social and geographical worlds are sites of love and remembrance, as the lines immediately before the final ones assert, and as Hölderlin's memory of France evokes. But in the end, the poetic word is what grounds the existential. So what kind of knowledge about the poetic word, then, can aesthetics, with its subsets, poetics, theory, critique, exegesis, method, offer? If an aesthetics is active, what is it doing? Even if we assume that most ideal operations for that discursive mode, absent the neuroses and symptoms of control, repudiation, mastery or civility, delimitation, secondariness, anxiety, envy even, can an active aesthetics, an aesthetics that does, burn off the fat of those neuroses and symptoms, producing the tanned, fit body it always dreamed of? Can aesthetics morph into a kind of silver fox, joiny harmony, where it can make some meaningful connections? Or, in digital mode, take a bold scientific approach to meeting and matching? They might have met online, but it's good to see that aesthetics and poetic praxis might be able to go for long walks along the beach to explore their compatibility. John Kinsella's activist aesthetics, Anarchy in the Avon Valley, of 2010, is the most multifaceted inquiry into these kinds of questions in Australian writing so far. It includes autobiographical cameos of involvement in environmental and other protests, and manifestos of activist political writing about pacifism, bioethics, eco-critical humanism, refugee asylum seeker policy, land management, geodysplasia, the prosody of telecommunications, activist readings of poems by other Australian poets, vegan ethics, environmentalism, anarchism as a social allegiance, and the inclusion of poetry in the design of courts of justice. Its explicit dialogue with Hope's anti-activist poetics is also apparent in the activist reading of Hope's 1948 poem, The Death of the Bird. Judith Wright is the only other Australian poet who has embedded his or her poetry and poetics as firmly in social, environmental and political issues. Throughout this huge range of engagement, sites and projects, Kinsella offers a template of the poet as activist. "For me," he writes, "poetry has no point unless it's a prompt to aid to political and ethical change. This is not to say that a poem should be political or ethical instruction," his emphasis, "but rather that I might engender a dialogue between the poem itself and the reader or listener, between itself and other poems and texts, and between all of these and a broader public, whatever that might be. I see myself as a poet activist. Every time I write a poem, it is an act of resistance to the state, the myriad hierarchies of control, and the human urge to conquer our natural surroundings. In using the language tools I have inherited, and at times seek to alter, neologistically, even dismantle, I'm inevitably part of what I critique. I am complicit." So the poetics of resistance and complicity. Then a conjuncture that recognises the linguistic commonality of aesthetics and the poetic word, and less banally, the normative hierarchies of cultural and sociable language, and that rejects, like Hope, any role for the poem in instilling social justice dispositions. At the same time, contra Hope, Kinsella's poetics doesn't claim the purity and sanctity of the origin of the poetic word in the fiction of the imagination. As in Hölderlin, it blows across the landscape and out of the past. But it arrives as a gifting, a founding. It's blated, not anterior. It circles the Oesterberg, gathering contradictions and disturbing analogies until it arrives. But questions remain. What is the poem itself here? I mean, theoretically and discursively. Is it just another example of that endless chit-chat about the poem that riddles poetics? All very pleasant, and nothing wrong with that, and sometimes amusing. And the idea of dialogue, how and when does that happen exactly? A useful approach here, I thought, might be to look at Kinsella's Divine Comedy, Journeys Through a Regional Geography, 2008, if only because it shares a geographical locale with the activist poetics writing. The poem preceded the poetics, though, at least in publication, which is worth considering. The Divine Comedy is a book-length poem, though, that re-territorialises Dante's medieval Christian epic onto a five and a half acre block of land on the outskirts of York, the oldest inland settlement in the West Australian Wheatbelt and a town of the Avon Valley. Upending the European epic, not just recycling it, you'd think is both active and activist. It's a serial poem, excuse me, with affiliations to modernist works like Williams's Paterson and to longer postmodern works like Armand Schwerner's The Tablets, even Susan Howe's Europe of Trusts, and their thematics of cyclical human culture, ruin, and procedural composition. That's another complicated story. Kinsella's re-territorialisation of Dante's Three Canticles distracts, collapses, and reformats his original schema, Dante's original schema, in multiple ways. For example, it begins with Purgatory, up close, followed by Paradiso, Rupture, and ends with Inferno, Leisure Centre. The journeys through these imaginatively terraformed landscapes are through multiple entries and exits and are repetitions, not unidirectional across souls always moving in circles, as in Dante. It's a highly concentrated regional geography with roads and tracks into actual places. But like Dante's imaginary worlds, it has travelled through via language and mentalities. Kinsella frequently evokes the Möbius strip in relation to the inseparability of his three realms, canticles, states of mind. Like Dante, Kinsella seems furiously to pursue his critique of government, settlement, history, and global mythography, all those topics debated and investigated in activist poetics, while travelling through heaven, hell, and purgatory. Dante's epic provides the template for Kinsella's poetic resistance and complicity, while a small block of land outside York provides its geography. There are lots of other levels. Astronomy, microscopically fine calibrations of place and floral names, animal life, local politics, national politics, regional environmental history, geology, bad land management, allegorization of children's toys, the nationhood of ants, etc., etc. The journey through this regional geography, deeply layered in Noongar, settlement and geological time, is at least as allegorical and fractally imagined as Dante's through his tri-world Commedia. Every bit of Dante's poem that Kinsella breaks off contains its antipodal equivalent, however revisioned, reoriented, distracted. The third of these geostates, Inferno, is spatially rearranged with other circles and layers and strips and echoes in place of Dante's circles, pits, ditches, pouches. Hell is an easy place to populate, mainly with oneself, he writes. It is this section that is reconnected with in the Buzzard poem, from the small medieval town in the on the outskirts of Stuttgart, Tübingen. The York district's Walwallinge, renamed Mount Bakewell by English surveyor Ensign Dale in 1830, is both a threatened earthly paradise and a kind of portal into another world. But Kinsella's Inferno is not the place of nuclear abomination, pesticides, land degradation, genocide, and political horror in the same way that his Purgatorio is. It does have elements of them, as he writes, but the prime drift is psychological. Inferno is the place where we are all complicit, where the cliché is paramount rather than twists of words. They too have their place, as exclusion and rejection, othering, and the subalternizing. Make for a concept of Babel in which none of us understands those outside our immediate circles. Inferno is internationally regional. We're all there with the same possibility of trauma and wrongdoing. Yesterday morning, we heard a moving and eloquent narrative about language and land from Vincent Medina of the Ohlone people. Vincent's gestures were about the region, the mountain, the bay, he pointed, the ocean, and about language revival and political resistance. Lindhagenian's sense of the time being right for a conversation between far separated regions of the world about their contemporary poetry and poetic traditions is what has brought us here and together. Language is obviously at the centre of that initiative as well. John Kinsella's international regionalism, as he calls it, is complexly and powerfully embodied in the activist poetics writing and in the Divine Comedy, and it's about a region far from here. But the evidence is, remember the poet prompted by watching birds circling above a hill in provincial Germany, thinking about his home region's hellish leisure centres a hemisphere away, their Aboriginal significance, and the circling wedgetails, the covert violence of remote anti-terrorism operations, and the literary language of military ordnance. That neither the poetic word nor the heterogeneous secondary discourse, aesthetics, is unimplicated or politically correct. That is why dialogues represented by this colloquium are vital. They provide the opportunity for understanding between regions and the fascinating specificity of how the poetic word arrives and how aesthetics reveals what it wants. Thank you.